like to acknowledge my presence in unceded Coast Salish territory for a number of reasons, primarily because I'm speaking about law this evening, and the hypocrisy of not following my own law while speaking of it would be incomprehensible. And it's something I'll speak to in a moment as we go through the presentation. I'd like to acknowledge my mom and my dad. They were on the front lines of oil and gas long before I was. That might be in part where I came from. And so I come by this honestly. I'd like to honor them for supporting me and for bringing me into this world and straightening me out when I got a bit too ridiculous. The hair didn't work, but everything else was cool. Okay, so let's see if this works. There we go. Okay, so I want to start with this. This is Sack Edge Henderson. Some of you guys in this room know who he is, probably know him personally. I thought this was a really apt quote, something that stuck with me as I've studied law. I'm going to begin with a mihi mihi. And the reason I'm going to do this, it's a traditional Maori introduction. And I'm going to read it in English. And the reason I'm doing this is because I'll be referring, if we have time, to some Maori law, some stuff I picked up when I was in Aotearoa. And I felt it, again, appropriate and consistent with my own law to show that respect and to convey my respect for them publicly. Because I don't ever want to take without giving back. That's the colonizer's way, and I never, ever want to have that in myself, especially now as we talk about these things and this potential. So I'll have to project. What it says is, Turtle Island is that which carries me. My mountains are Clin Saeza, the Beatty Peaks, the Twin Sisters. My people are my rivers, are the Peace, the Musqueam, and the Liard, and my nations, the Etchedene and the Duneza. Charlene Wilderman and Roland Wilson are my rangatira, my chiefs. And the land is my marae, it's my home. And as you'll see, the last thing on that is my name, Caleb Bain. And I think that speaks to the importance that I have relative to the issues that I speak about. You know, I'm just a person. I thank you all for coming. But what I'm speaking about has very little to do with me. I've been lucky enough to pick up bits and pieces and be trained by some very brilliant people. But it's the first bits that are important. But the last bit is my name, Caleb Bain. So here's the outline. In an hour and a half, I'm going to try and get through 61 slides and a whole bunch of really ridiculous abstract concepts. A lot of you, I think, have seen me speak before. I'm going to be using a lot of the same slides, primarily because I'm sick for the last week and I just couldn't figure out a way to articulate the issues and conflicts that I see in northeastern British Columbia without using the slides I've used before. To speak about solutions and my vision of the solutions, I have to show you what the issues are. For those of you who are familiar with the Northeast, and there's a couple in the crowd, this would be obvious to you, but again, I'll do my best to be quick and just power through that. And then, of course, more importantly, I'll talk about legal pluralism, reconciliation, and Indigenous laws, and how they kind of fit together and work together, and what their potential might be. And I'll end with some concluding thoughts, and I'll actually gonna challenge you guys as a consequence of this at the end, but we'll wait to the end for that. One of the many things I do whenever I speak is acknowledge my biases and acknowledge where I'm from and my background. Because I try and live traditionally to the extent that I can, I have to admit that I have a bias. The things I speak about tonight are not only based upon my experiences in Treaty 8, in British Columbia in particular. I'm tempted to talk about SAGD development, I'm tempted to talk about the tar sands, I'm tempted to talk about litigation in Alberta, but that's not my territory. My territory is British Columbia. So for those of you hoping to hear a lot about SAGD and tar sands and stuff like that, I don't really feel it's appropriate for me to posit the kinds of laws that might be applicable in that environment, despite the fact that some of those people are my kin, and I've worked with some of them. I think the principles I'm talking about, some of the applications and some of the theories I develop and kind of put forward to you might be useful, but I can only speak for myself. And as myself, this is my reality. The picture up there is me with my first caribou shot in Kaska territory pursuant to Kaska law. I had to give away everything of that first one, or else my medicine for hunting would be bad. The last piece actually I gave to John Borrow was my first day of Indigenous law in second year a long time ago. That's my grandma doing a hide. And that's a very poor dry meat rack. But the point with this is just that my background, my biases come from this lifestyle close to the land. Treaty 8, these are the two nations my mother and father are from, respectively. Fort Nelson and West Moberly. Treaty 8 signed 1899, we adhered in 1910. The point with this, notice this map. Treaty 8 does not entirely contain the Western Canadian sedimentary, quite clearly. But an appreciable chunk, especially the tar sands and the frack fields in Northeast BC, definitely contained. It's Treaty 8 country. And that's why I approached this issue the way I did. But again, I have to admit that my territory is this. And this is big, this is huge, but it's not the whole of it. Here's some figures in the size of the Western Canadian sedimentary. I think over $500 billion. And this is 2011 estimates based upon an article put out a week ago by the Globe and Mail, primarily. The value of this environment, this space, is ridiculous. Over $500 billion recoverable at today's market value. And that's just in bitumen. I mean, you add up the gas and the rest, this is a significant resource. And what comes with this resource is conflict. Part of the conflicts, and we mentioned sort of blockades and things like that, is based upon these. This is a map of the pipeline infrastructure of North America. My territory is right here from my dad. My mom's from down around here. This is the energy grid for petroleum and hydrocarbons in North America at this point. There's a lot proposed in this area, as many of you know. And there's issues with that. So, for example, my friend from school, Togastai, him and his people, the Wet'suwet'en and the Stoughton clan, are standing against the PDP line and all gas, all frack gas, all of it. And so the issues and conflicts that come from my territory are propagating and spreading out. And I'll talk about why that is and some of the implications derived therefrom. I'll do my best to run through all of this as quickly as I can. I just want people to understand what I'm talking about. This is a simple slide just describing the difference between conventional and unconventional gas. Simple point. Horizontal drilling, hydraulic fracturing. That's the only difference. There's issues with both, quite simply. But one of the unique things about this is that when you do unconventional gas, like in my territory, you see things like this. This is Chesapeake Statoil. So what you see on the surface is nice because it's not as much, you know, ridiculous well pads everywhere, but subsurface, each of these little kind of puffy looking things is a fracturing event. Now this is actually inaccurate. What would be done is like between 8 and 20, 22 wells thrown onto a pad, shot down, the radial pattern going out. And then you frack it all, and you see how they line up and they move together. So the subsurface impact is significant. And my point with this is not to lambast anybody or say it's so negative or so bad, but more to suggest that the implications and the consequences of this development are poorly understood, especially when you consider what's on the surface versus what's below.